It was interesting to hear your introductions. I found a lot of people coming from rural areas, some from Nebraska, Iowa, Texas. I didn't hear of many being from Oklahoma, and that's the land of my birth, from California, from back up north and east, and that's interesting. I didn't hear of many being born like out in the state of Washington or Oregon in that area, so it's interesting to see where you're from. Also, it's interesting to see the sizes of families that you come from. I believe 9 was the largest. Is there anyone here that comes from a family, brothers and sisters, larger than 9? Yes. 10. Anybody topping that? 12. How many were only children? 1, 2. Okay. How many had just one other sibling, one other brother or sister? Okay. So by and large, you come from fairly sizable families. And that's interesting to me because you're in a people-oriented business. And if you haven't thought of yourself as being a people person up until recently, as you have been working in the healthcare centers, I'm certain that you've recognized that you have to become a people person, right? I have had opportunity all down through my life to have a great deal of interaction. At the time that Dan and I first met, when I was music director at a church in Tulsa, I was going to college then. In fact, my wife tells our friends I've been going to college all my life, and some people just need more of it than others because they don't ever seem to quite get where they're supposed to be going. But I was going to college at that time, working in the church, but doing a lot of visiting as a result of helping our senior minister, visiting in a number of nursing homes. And I found that it was very important to me as I came to know a number of the senior citizens, and then also a couple of paraplegics that were involved in nursing care center there in Tulsa, come to love very deeply because of who they were as persons. When I first came to the city of Denver to purchase a small practice from a psychologist who moved to Seattle, Washington, our offices were located in a nursing home. And just across the way from where our office was, which was just one room at that time, was a young man from western Kansas who had been involved in a diving accident. He was out swimming with some of his buddies on a 4th of July weekend and paralyzed himself by injury that he had. Very bright young man, but quite paralyzed from his waist down. He had lots of determination, lots of integrity, and just a ferocious will to do and to be. Very good friend today. I'll call her Jeanette. I'll not give you her last name. But she's been a beautiful inspiration to me. She is our bookkeeper. Jeanette, some 14, 15 years ago, and just in her 20s, was an officer in a bank in Longmont, Colorado. And she was driving down in the state of Texas, helping tow some cars. Her family had a used car business, and she was helping to bring a car back. And the car behind hers was not quite hooked correctly, and it caused an accident which threw her out of her car, and she was paralyzed from the waist down. And since that time, Jeanette has had 2 boys, and now she is a single parent because her husband left her about 4 years ago. She's a lovely person. Her 2 boys are now 10 and 7, and she's just a phenomenal character, and I call her a character because there's very little that she will not do. She drives the van that she has, a Ford van, has one of those elevator things on the side. She has a riding lawnmower that she mows the grass with. It also has a snow blade on the front of it that when it snows, she scrapes out the snow from her yard or from the driveway to get the van out. She has a lot of will, a lot of determination. she's a beautiful person because she has refused to succumb to certain things that others might succumb to, and she's become a person because part of her motivation has been to raise those boys. Part of the rest of it's because she wanted to do things in life, and that's great. All this centers around who we come to realize that we are as persons. Who are we as persons? You know, not just why are you here today, but why did this week go like it went? You know, sometimes weeks go well and sometimes they go bad. Why has this year gone like it's gone? For some of us, it's been good. For others of us, it's been bad. Why has the last 5 years gone good or gone bad? A lot of that centers around part of what we expect to happen within our lives. Let's remove ourselves from this locale right here and go back to our teenage years when we might have attended the school prom. Back, you know, in the ice age for some of you, you know, some of us. Going to a school prom and guys were very, very nervous, or, well, maybe, you know, they wanted to ask a girl to dance and they weren't sure that she would accept. And so they would run over and say, hey, I'd like this dance. And if she said yes, fine, they'd grab her arm, and she didn't say, well, I didn't want to dance anyway. Oftentimes, when we're interacting with people, we find that it's really scary to get on the line. Now, in a real gutsy way, some of you have several people that you are supervising in your responsibilities. And if their work is done well, then you may or may not get a pat on the back. But if their work is not done well, you're pretty sure that you will get a pat very low on the back. And so it's important to you that they do their work, or if you are singular in your situation where you've got that total responsibility, it has to be done. And it's up to you to see that it's done. How do we do that? Part of that involves around who we see ourselves. Now, I heard some of you saying that you see yourselves as an employee. You see yourselves as mothers, as fathers, as wives, as husbands, as parents. Some of you with glee talked about seeing yourselves as grandparents. And I've always thought, you know, I'm really not a person who believes in reincarnation, but if I did, I would really want to come back the next time around, not as a child, but as a grandchild. It's much easier that way, folks. It really is. You don't have all the flack of parents telling you no, because grandparents are just automatic falls for anything. You know, you can say ice cream, you can say cookie, you can say anything, and grandparents will fall for it because they're highly indulgent. Kids have their ups and downs, and in many ways, we are children inside. We have feelings like the little child, and with those feelings, it's difficult sometimes to relate what it's like. I love to watch little kids and experiment with them. When our first daughter, who's now 12, was born, or just slightly after that, I was taking my first course in developmental psychology. And this is where they tell you that at certain ages they're supposed to sit up, and another age they're supposed to crawl, another age they're supposed to be able to say daddy. And our first daughter learned to say daddy very early, and my wife would kick me on the leg and say, she's calling you, she's calling you. And this was in the middle of the night, you know. So I learned to be domesticated. She's a neat little girl. Beth is a neat little girl. But she also learned that daddy could be communicated with, because I care a great deal about her. I care a great deal about her. All this involves our concept with regard to who we are. In working with both our girls, when they came along to being in about the 12, 14, 18, 24, to about 36 month span of time, you know, children that time, at that point in life will say, instead of I want, they'll say, me wants a glass of water. That's just automatic in the way they learn to speak. And I would tease them. You know, I'm me, and they're them. And so I would say, you know, I would point to me. Me doesn't want a glass of water. And Beth would say, no, Daddy, me wants a glass of water. Now, I realize this is in communication styles, but as I would keep edging over, and finally, I'd say, who is it in this room that wants a glass of water? And she'd say, Beth. She at least knew that her name was Beth. So in the process of trying to get it across to me what she wanted, she finally resorted to her given name. You say, Jim, that's Henri. Yes, I know it's Henri. But we were working with the concept of who she was. Going back for just about 30 or 45 seconds to where you were working yesterday, or where you were working Saturday or last Friday, you know, and those people that you're interacting with, the patients in the home, the other staff members, who do they perceive that they are? And in relationship, who do they perceive that you are? Are you simply a pile of sheets or pillows? Pillowcases? Are you a mop handle? You know, are you the person that's just there only to clean up a mess in the middle of the floor? Or to make certain that the rug's been shampooed or that the floors have been polished? You know, who are you? Who are they? We're persons. And one of the things that happens so desperately in our lifestyle here in America is the fact that often we get gripped with depression. Now, I don't know whether you're an early person or whether you're a nocturnal person. If you're an early riser, that's great because, you know, you can get things done in an early fashion. I'm a nocturnal person. I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, but not because I want to. That's because society goes that direction, and I cooperate somewhat with society. But, you know, you wake up on Monday morning or whatever day of the week your week starts, and it's time to get in gear. And you have to do a little self-talking. Now, Jim, put your feet on the floor and stand up. And then you say, now, you know, get in there and get your wife's coffee made. I feel like I'm real benevolent, folks, and I crow about this because I haven't drunk coffee for about 3 or 4 years. And every morning I make my wife's coffee for her. And, of course, I let her remind her. I remind her how good I am about doing that. But I get that made and make myself a cup of tea. And then I go shave what little bit I shave and get cleaned up for the morning. And then we start the day with the kids. They both need time alone to kind of get things organized, because they're as strong-willed and as stubborn as I am. And if we, you know, have too much heavy interaction to begin with, the day gets started in sort of a sour note. So their clothes are laid out, and they can get a chance to get into them. Daddy gets back upstairs, and that's my interaction time with the kids. I fix breakfast for two girls that are neat. I mean, really neat. We have a good time of interaction because I work late in the evenings most of the time, 4 days a week. So it's important to get that time together. And there we can talk about what's happened. We can share. We can do lots of things dealing with around who they are as persons. And sometimes, for that little second grader, it's important to look at the paper to see how well she drew her A's on the page or whether she crossed her T's or not, if she spelled the right word, spelled the words correctly, or if she made her fours backwards, which has happened some of the time. We do a lot of those things, but all the time we're recognizing her for herself. And I like to be recognized for who I am. That's really important. And I think it's important for us to be able to say, I need to be recognized for who I am. Now, Dan,
my good friend,
introduced me as Jim Collins,
a psychologist.
But, you know, 35, 40 years ago, if you had been introduced to me, you'd been introduced to Jim Collins, Carl's son, because my dad's name is Carl. A few years from now, I'll probably be introduced as the father of one of my two girls. See, it's all in perspective of what people think about us, but also what we think about ourselves. You know, I heard some real neat talents coming around as you were introducing yourselves. Some of you had some unusual pets. I've never thought of having a pet pig. There were just some, and I'll think of some of these other things in a little bit, of things that make you uniquely you. I've got to worm out some of you folk that said you couldn't think of anything because I think you may have the raciest life going. And you didn't want to divulge too much of it because you might think you were going to start a scandal or something, and none of us want scandals here today. You know, oftentimes we forget to stop and smell the roses while we're walking down the path. And it really means a lot. You know? It really means a lot that we learn to stop and see what's there. And to add to your experience so that when you go home and are facing your family, your friends, get up fairly early in the morning and walk up as high as you dare on the hills and see the early morning sunrise. I've been down here for about three conferences, and it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, it's just beautiful. It just kind of gives you a high without having to do it with chemicals. It's great to get out here. Okay, our personage, the person that we are, is the self. That's, you know, tall, short, fat, skinny, blonde-headed, straight hair, curly hair, dark hair. Also, the self is the person that we are, the character that we are. That's not bad or good necessarily. That's just the person that we are. And then the image. What do you see when you look in a mirror and you say, oh, Jim, now let's not get into that. You know, just look into a mirror and who are you? I don't mean the physical image of who you see, but who are you down deep inside? Because all this we're going to bear into the theme in just a little bit of what happens when stresses come our way and what we do with our stresses. In the clinic, we have a number of interns that are working with us, and one of the things that we do is use some little, they've got rubber-handled what we call batakas, and it's just sponge. We used to have some kapok ones, but it's sponge with canvas over it. They're not harmful at all, but we can use those little orange-colored things to get a lot of aggression out. We've got an intern who's about 25 years of age. Rich is a neat fellow. Little Marky is about 9.5 or 10. And Marky has had an awful lot of anger about the fact that his daddy ran off and left him, he and his mother and his brother and his sister. And Mark couldn't seem to get it out. He just really had some difficulty, started making bad grades in school. He started writing rather naughty notes and leaving them around for the teacher to find. And, of course, she found them, just like he had planned. And she reacted just as negatively as he had planned. And he hadn't planned, however, for Mother to come to school. And that brought a new scenario into the action. And then they had a parent-teacher conference. And finally, little Marky wound up in the office. We started working and found out he wasn't a very good artist, so we couldn't have him draw on a blackboard. We have these whiteboards with colored markers, you know, and they're really neat for getting out a lot of expression. But he wasn't a very good artist, and that didn't help a little bit, but just a little bit. When it was warm last summer, we had him playing a little handball, tossing the ball and a little basketball outside with the intern. And then after it got a little colder, we decided to use the batakas. And a few weeks ago, he was just wailing the tar out of Rich, the intern. And as we were going along in the process. Now, we did some talking and other things too. I said to Rich, at some point when Marky's just really angry, why don't you ask him in the middle of one of those swings if he sees Daddy on the end of that bataka? He was just wailing away. Sure enough, little Marky was seeing in that young intern the image of his father, and he was getting some aggression out. But he was doing it in a very good setting. He didn't hurt anybody, didn't break any windows. He didn't rob any banks. He didn't go out and get drunk. He didn't wreck a car. He didn't do any of those things. We were dealing with some of those things, and he's dealing with who he is as a person. Because many times, children kind of get a feeling that they are the cause of parental conflict many times. Not even when they're not, they get that feeling, almost like it's magic. With the two types of self-image, there's negative and positive. And if we feel good about ourselves, and there are a lot of positive things that happen in our youth, it's great. Negative things tend to scar us just a little bit. And on the basis of that, I'm going to give you, in a little while, a couple of things for you to do for yourself. Nobody else is going to see them, but I just want you to share them. I want you to see how you feel about you. And it's not to threaten you or anybody else. In fact, we don't want anybody else to see them. You just keep them with your own things and don't even put your name on them. And that way, there's no way that others can be threatened with it. Now, dealing with self-image, and Dan, would you come up? I want to give this one out. Just one moment here. Go ahead and hand these out. And then this one. Most of you have those little yellow pads there, and we will start what's coming to you. We'll work with just a little bit later. Right now, I want you to check about your own self-image. I have 20 items down here. The answers are on the board here. Isn't it neat to have the answers to the test? All we've got to do is make up the questions. Now, can you see this? I didn't do too well in penmanship when I was in grade school, and then I learned to type, so I don't say that that's... The R is for rarely, S for seldom, O for often, and U for usually. Now, one of the things I want you to do is just, as we're asking these questions, you number 1 through 20, and I'll just read the question, give you about 30 seconds to put the answers down here. R, S, O, U, one of the four. And this way, we can do a little self-assessment. Now, this isn't for management. This isn't for anybody else. This is not for you to take back and show to your husband or your wife or your kids or your parents. This is just for you. You got about 4 or 5 numbers written down there. We'll start out and ask the questions. And you answer for you. And this is just strictly for yourself. Question number 1. I make friends easily. Those answers would be R for rarely, S for seldom, O for often, U for usually. Now, if you happen to miss one of these, just remember the number and we'll come back, pick it up for you. Number 2, I make good decisions. Number 2, I make good decisions. Number 3, I feel competent on my job. Number 3, I feel competent on my job. Number four, I am open to new growing experiences. I am open to new growing experiences. That was number four. Am I going too fast? You're with me? Okay, I'll speed up just a teeny bit. Number five, I respond objectively during crisis situations. Number five, I respond objectively during crises situations. Number six, I laugh frequently. I laugh frequently. Number seven, I'm considered responsible by others. I'm considered responsible by others. Number eight, I am considerate of others. I am considerate of others. Nine, I take charge of my life. I take charge of my life. Number 10, I meet my commitments. Number 10, I meet my commitments. Number 11, I enjoy my life. I enjoy my life. Number 12, I am thoughtful. I am thoughtful. Number 13, I feel I am respected by others. I feel I am respected by others. Number 14, I am creative. I am creative. Number 15, I am successful. I am successful. Number 16, I follow through on my plans. Number 16, I follow through on my plans. Number 17, I have an active social life. I have an active social life. Number 18, I enjoy being alone sometimes. I enjoy being alone sometimes. Number 19, members of the opposite sex find me attractive. 19, members of the opposite sex find me attractive. Now this is to blend in with the test that Dan gave you so that you can tell just how that balances out. Okay? And then number 20, I am loving to others. So you can take that however you want to take it. I am loving to others. Okay. Now a quick rundown. For each often that you circled, that's an O, give yourself 1 point. For often equals 1 point. Usually, give yourself 2 points. Okay, the maximum for the score for the test is 40, so if you loaded it to 44, we'll penalize you a little bit there. But this is just for you. To deal with for yourself. If you marked often, give yourself 1 point. If you marked usually, give yourself 2 points. Okay, got them counted up? I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands. That's not important. But if you scored, you know, midpoint or better, from 20 to 40, it's a pretty good sign that you're feeling pretty good about yourself. And that's good. That's what we want. That's what Bethesda wants. And as you're feeling good about yourself. That's really important. I believe you had passed out to you this little pyramid. We'll talk about that for a moment. Which is extremely important for basic to the understanding of ourselves is, in psychological jargon, what Shostrom put together as our basic needs, beginning with our physical needs, down on the bottom, food, air, and water. That we really can't do without. Basic. And then our safety needs of future survival, lack of fear. If you've ever noticed a little child fearful, they come for comfort. They come so that we can comfort them. It may be something that we don't consider to be something to be afraid of, but if they're afraid of it, it has great stress for them. And it's important for us to understand that. Then we come to our love and belonging needs, which involve our status, our care, sympathy, listening and being listened to, communication with others, our sexuality of who we are, and contrary to the modern philosophy, you need to be thankful for your own sexuality, of who you are as a person. It's important. And then the willingness to share and the need for intimacy, the need for importance. And I think one of the things when I had the initial conversation with Dan and Don concerning coming down to speak to you today, the thing that impressed me with their presentation to me was their concern about you as persons. Some of you they'd never met, but were extremely concerned that you be recognized for who you are and not feel that you were going neglected or unnoticed, either for you as a person or for the job that you were doing. And that's pretty neat, because a lot of companies don't consider that. And then building to an understanding of recognizing who we are, our capabilities, our limitations, and all that goes with that. Then the esteem needs. One of the things that's important about this hierarchy here of the pyramid as it builds is that we can't move up to the next level until the needs of that particular level are met. For instance, if I don't know if I'm going to have a meal to eat tonight or tomorrow, I don't care much about my self-esteem. I'm simply groping to find out if I'm going to have food to eat or if I don't have shelter. Some of those other things kind of go by the board. But by the time we get up to our esteem needs, we're looking for respect and being able to commit ourselves to something. And some of you are probably, how many of you are supervising 3 or 4 or 5 or more employees? Have a number that you're supervising? Yes. You probably watch pretty closely to see what's happening. And if John or Mary or Bill or Susan or whoever it is says, yes, I'll do a certain thing, and they don't do it, and about the 4th or 5th time around, you know, you start getting a little upset, even irritated inside, because they said that they would do it. They committed themselves, and then they don't. And then you begin to kind of judge their statements by what you know yourself to experience. If they say that they'll come into work at 7 o'clock, and they wind up getting there at 9:30, you're a little upset, and rightfully so, because you probably have jobs lined up for them. And you have to bear in mind, and pressure of the whole working system is upon you to get those jobs done. And understanding what's happening in that person is extremely important. Maybe he's not or she's not meeting some of those lower level needs, so that commitment is not quite where it should be. And they're being able to perform the job in the way that they should. Then, getting into the area of achievement. I heard someone who had gotten, I believe my notes were right, got 15 place ribbons in the sixth grade. I thought that was neat. I had a little smarting of envy for someone that was that industrious, realizing that I must have been lazy by their standards, and the fact that I didn't get that many ribbons. That's all right then. I'm glad that person did. Then we get to companionship. None of us can actually live in an isolated vacuum. One of the things, and one of the ladies over here, and it came by me so that I didn't get a chance. I was making another little note. Was in prison. Well, I was in prison too. I think you worked there, or I went to sing there, and I work there. I like to clarify that most of the time. In fact, for those of you who are down in Canyon, I come down to visit once a month, and to date, they've always let me come in and go out the same day. I appreciate that. And check on things, how things are going down there in the mental health department. I have a particular bent in that direction, for I was a psychologist in federal prison down in southern Illinois, at Marion, Illinois, the one that replaced Alcatraz. Rather heavy environment. We had quite an elite group of gentlemen that we serviced down there, not because they desired to be with us, but because we chose to have them with us. It was interesting, however, because even in that environment, I found, I'll tell you about Joe. Just got a letter last week from Joe. Hadn't planned to tell you this, but I will. Joe is probably 35, 37 years of age now. Joe is in prison for being an accomplice in a bank robbery back in the state of Illinois. And, you know, till I went to prison, I didn't realize there were so many people who'd rob banks in the whole world. You know, banks are where you put money, but they decided that was a place where you took it out, and you either did it before hours or after hours, or with a little extra force. And, well, before I tell you about Joe, I've got to tell you about Bill. Bill was a pretty neat chap. He'd pass for any one of you here, not you ladies, but you guys. And I was pretty much of a greenhorn when it came to dealing with character disorders and people in prison. And I remember first day I went in to see Bill. He was in for bank robbery, and he had made a lot of money robbing banks, just lots of money. And I was setting my sails to try to convince him that what he had done was wrong. And he was a little wiser than I, and had lived a little longer, and knew how to handle we shrinks. And so I started laying my trip and my questions on him, and he looked at me with all the innocence of an 8-month-old child and said, "Hey, Doc," he said, "you know, all I did was buy a $100,000 home." And this, now, this was back in 1972, and $100,000 home back in 1972 in Kentucky were big houses. And he said, "I just took that money and bought a house for my aged mother." And he says, "Do you want me to get rid of that house and set her in the street?" And after about 20 minutes of dialogue, I begin to feel sorry for his dear mother. I mean, after all, who wants a 70-year-old woman to have to sleep out in the street at night? I came out of that session after about 50, 60 minutes, came walking down the hall, get a cup of tea, and I guess I looked like I had been put through a ringer. And my boss said to me, "You've seen Bill, haven't you?" He didn't know I'd seen Bill. He just saw the way I looked, and he said, "You've seen Bill, haven't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Which way did the sun come up today?" And I said, "Well, I thought it came up in the east this morning, but I'm not sure which direction it came up in." Because he was so pervasive in his struggle with me, trying to get me to see that it was okay. I mean, after all, if you only rob national banks, they're insured. I didn't know all this data. They're insured by the Federal Reserve, and nobody loses any money. You just take it, and then you go buy your mother $100,000 house, and she can live there while you're in prison. And I had a real challenge trying to figure that one out and dealing with Bill in the months ahead that I was there. However, there was Joe, a gentleman that was placed as my secretary in prison. Joe was 28, 29 years of age when he was my secretary. At the age of 3, by the court, Joe was taken away from his parents. He was placed in a foster home, and between age 3 and age 10, he was placed in 23 foster homes. And at age 10, he said to himself, if they ever put me in another home, I don't care how good or how bad it is, I'm going to stay there till I get to be grown. He was placed on a farm with a family, and there he stayed until his 18th birthday when he joined the Air Force. Went and served his country, came home, back to a Midwestern state, and there he was working in a very good job. He'd gained quite a bit of stature and feeling pretty good about himself, but he didn't have roots. Joe didn't have roots. He didn't have those guidelines that some of us have. And one of his buddies got to talking to him, and Joe, you know, had bills just like you have bills. He had gotten married, and then they had some sickness, and that caused doctor bills, and some of you know about that. It was just difficult for him. So his buddy got to talking to him that, you know, there was this little town that they could go down and you know, just lift a little money out of the bank, and wouldn't hurt, and nobody'd catch him because it's just a little bitty town. Well, what actually happened, to pull the story down into about 3 minutes, was the fact that when they pulled into that little town for his buddy to go into the bank, it just so happened that the sheriff was only a block and a half away. And the sheriff felt very kindly about the banker and all the employees of the bank, and he didn't especially care for people coming in with guns trying to take money out of the bank unauthorized. Joe wound up in prison for 7 years. In the process of really coming to grips with the fact that he had never established some really strong values for himself, he didn't really know what was black and he didn't know what was white, and he had difficulty determining the various shades of gray. He really did. So it was difficult for him, and it was in that process of about 5-6 years while he was inside the walls of that federal prison that he really began to come to grips with his value system. Now, it's strange that some people, you know, learn that in school. Some people learn it at the hands of Grandma or Aunt Susie or Aunt Maud or Uncle Joe. Others learn it in various other situations in life, other ways of influence that comes to them, where they began to get some value structure for themselves. Joe got his in prison. When I left the prison and went to Southern Illinois University to teach in the corrections division, just about that time, he came up for parole, and I sponsored him on parole. He became my student assistant at the university. There he finished his degree, and just last week, I got a letter from Joe. And I am as proud of that letter as I can be. He's finished his bachelor's degree, he's finished his master's degree in psych, and he's been hired in a mental health unit up in northwest Missouri. Married, very fine young lady. They have a little 5-year-old girl. He is directing the alcohol and drug rehab program for drug and alcohol offenders and juvenile program in northwest Missouri. Because someone cared to invest some time and some energy in him. Now, that may sound like a dramatic story, and I'm not asking all of you to go to prison so that you can find another Joe and that you can sponsor them coming out of prison. But I'm really thrilled. In fact, Joe's just finished writing a book dealing with foster parenting, and I'm really proud of it. But you have a way of touching the lives of other people. And you can touch their lives
in a very beautiful way. And that involves who you are as a person. And maybe they've got lots of insecurities, or maybe they feel good about themselves. Maybe it's that little person who might be 83 or 93 years of age that feels very lonely. One of the things that I have been made very aware of in the past few years, that many persons in healthcare facilities don't get the kind of visitation that I would want if I were living there as a resident. In fact, some of them are almost forgotten in many ways, which is a sad commentary on our whole social society. But we're there. And you may have just a minute, minute and a half, 2 minutes, to share a ray of sunlight on one of those lives. And with this, my mind's flashing a lot of things. I think most of you will enjoy this story, because some of my good friends who live up in the little town of Longmont just took it upon themselves, since one set of parents lived in the state of Oregon, another set of parents lived in New Jersey, and they were not able to have parents around for Thanksgiving and Christmas, and those holiday seasons, decided to invade one of the local nursing homes up there and adopt a granny for a day, which I think is kind of a neat kind of project. And the only thing that happened, and everybody cleared it, the administrator cleared it, and the supervisor cleared it and everything, and this particular granny hadn't had a visit in about 7 months from her kids. They live right in that locale, but they seemingly had to go on different streets and other places in town and didn't have a chance to get there. And so about 4 o'clock on Thanksgiving afternoon, the son decided, I probably out of guilt, that he would go visit his dearly beloved mother. Hadn't seen her for 8.5 months, but he decided to go visit her. Maybe his football team lost or something. I don't know exactly what the story was, but he decided to go. And he was horrified that she was gone. She was horrified that she was gone. Thing it was, she was enjoying herself tremendously. So he managed to get there on Friday to see just how she was doing, and found that she was all perky and bright because she'd had someone who cared a little bit about her. Well, you know, it's neat to be a caring person. And once we've come to a point where we can share those kinds of emotions and values with others, they help a lot. They help a great deal. That involves communication. And it may be difficult to communicate with a person who's about 75% deaf, or the stroke victim, or persons that may have a great deal of difficulty with senility or other problems. But that's part of the communication cycle. And if we give and give and give of our communication, it's going to come back around. I've got a little game that I want to draft, and you know, you came here by invitation, but I had an idea. It was kind of a, you know, a drafting invitation that those of you who came from those warm places like Kansas. I guess it's getting warm out in Kansas. I used to live in Topeka, so I can talk about Kansas. You came out here, nice, cool Colorado. Got a little game. I want to divide us up into about 6 different units. And Dan and Don chose, just, you know, like you're coming here from wherever you came from, we did a selection job of a number of people that will cooperate with us. And we promise not to take any blood. We promise not to embarrass you. We promise not to harm you physically in any way. But we'll kind of cloister. And one of the important things about this is we want 2 people working on each one of the games, and we want about 8 or 9 observers. Well, there are 60, Dan, how many, 64? 57 here. So if we have 2 people with about 7 or 8 observers, that'll work real well. And one of the things that we will do is put these 2 people back to back and see just how well they communicate. Now, we'll give you all a
card. One has the pattern on it. The other person has the pieces of the puzzle to put together. And all you have to do in the process of communication is for the person who has the puzzle to direct the person behind them who has the pieces to put the puzzle together. Now, for the first 5 or 7 minutes until we signal you, you just stand and watch if you're an observer and try your best not to help them. I know most of you in the nursing home business are born rescuers. You know, that person needs this, and so you go get it for them. But what we want you to do here is just observe what goes on in communication. And, pardon me. Dan, you want to, or Don, you want to read those names off? And then I'll let you segregate the people. I'd really like to have you, however, I got the drift that some of you are from the same town. I'd really prefer that you weren't in the same group because I want you to see what communication is like. You want to let me read these?
Yes, I think the check marks were the putters together. These are the tellers.
Okay. We have the tellers and the putters together. Okay, that's real scientific, isn't it? But it's a lot of fun. You'll enjoy it. I believe you will, very definitely. We'll ask, and I don't know, so as I read these names off you, would Patricia Moore come over in this corner by the organ? Patricia Moore. And would Tony, S-C-H-W-L-K-A, Tony Swolka, is that right? Come over, let's see, why don't we put... Are you Tony? Put you right over in the middle there, Tony. And Wilma Dieter? Okay. Back there in the alcove. Wilma, if you would please. That's three over there. And Marge Bunker, would you come over here in this corner? And Fran Betty. There you are, Fran. Would you step right at this hallway here? And then Geta Nelson, would you step over in the corner where the fellows are back there? Now, our other people, Mary Rickmeyer, would you come over here with this lady? And Carol Karish, if I'm really messing these names up, forgive me, please. The second one over here, Lorraine Robb, back there. Ann Davis, back over in this corner. Lola Rothfuss, here in the middle. And Steve Ruby, over here, Dan. Now. Okay. The first set, the first six of you that I called up are to be the tellers. The second set are the putters together. Now, I want the rest of you to cloister around, not really close, give them about 4 or 5 or 6 feet, and they're to stand, you know, with their shoulders not touching, but pretty close to each other. And then I will put the puzzles in a way that they can work them. And the putters together, would you kindly cover your eyes so that we don't give you any visual cues until we get you in the right spot? Because we don't want any cheating on this. After all, robbing banks and all those things are wrong. And I think it'll be interesting for you to look at what happens in communication. Now, there's some of you that are just going to ache to kind of help them. And if someone will kind of monitor the time, after 7 minutes, you can give them slight cues. But don't rescue and do the whole thing. Make them work a little bit.
That'll help. Okay, would each of you find, and now if you're, just make sure that you don't group up in the same towns, because we want you to get acquainted with some other people. Scoot over to one of the six groups, each of you, and just stand around and watch them. And we'll give the puzzles to them. When the tellers get your card, you hold it up to the front of you very carefully and make certain that the putters together don't see your card, and then I will come back around and give the putters together the pieces of the puzzle, and you watch how they're doing it, okay? Signal you to go, and someone in the group watch. And after 5 minutes of death struggle, you begin to help them with little verbal cues. It's really interesting, and I think you'll enjoy it a great deal. Okay, go ahead.
Do you understand?
Could I have your attention just a moment? Now, from the bystanders, all that you can say at this point is that's right or that's wrong. Don't give any other cues, but affirm or, you know, give them an encouragement, but don't tell them. I would say to those of you who are putting together, the shapes are the same color on both sides. Okay, hold it, hold it.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
information. Okay, I want to draw some ideas about this, and then we want to take just about a four-minute break. I don't know if you're familiar with Glen Eyrie or not, but there are a couple of very important places down the hall, and you can find them on your left and in about a four-minute break. But I want you to be thinking, especially those of you who are listening to the communication, of what it takes in trying to get a point across, like when you're trying to tell somebody, you know, that certain equipment is down there and you know it's down there, down in a storage room or it's down somewhere, and you know it's there, and you can't get your point across. Because they may be looking at the green point going north and you're looking at the red point going south. And it's just about the same in analogy when you're working, and it's just so interesting. You know, if I was a little bit more ornery today, but after all, this is Monday, so I've got to be good on Mondays, I would have let you go just a little longer, and it can build up a real sense of tension. The second time I did this with the guys in the prison, I almost got tarred and feathered, because I let them go for about 15, 20 minutes, but a couple of guys said, no, we don't want any help, we want to do it ourselves. But they had so much tension built up that they weren't listening, and it was so interesting because the other fellows that were inmates were listening and watching their verbal communication and seeing where they were missing the cues. And you got to see part of that. And thank you, those of you who were guinea pigs, we love you deeply because you helped us a great deal in seeing just what we do with words. You know, if you don't have a visual cue, that's one of the reasons why we have slide productions, we have printed matter and all those sorts of things that kind of help us visually with the cues, because it helps us to find where those points are and which way north is. Okay, let's take about a 4.5-5 minute break and come back. I've got something else for you. One of the things that often happens when we're endeavoring to communicate with other people is that point of misperception. You know, when you're endeavoring to help a person understand, there's an old adage, and I don't even know who is the author of it, but it's been around for a long, long time, a picture's worth a thousand words. We can talk and talk and talk, but oftentimes that little diagram, that little focus, seems to help us get through so that we can understand what's happening. Now, that leads us to a point of conflict resolution. How many of you folk are parents out there? How many of you have more than one child? Oh, boy. I think I saw some hands go up where they weren't parents, but that's all right. You know, in the process of trying to get things across, of trying to establish what's going on, on the back of the sheet of the hierarchy of needs, on the back side of here, we have a diagram of conflict resolution. One of the things we want to come to grips with is what happens when we perceive something a bit differently than our neighbor. Maybe it's an employee under us or working for us, or maybe it's an online supervisor. You're a supervisor of housekeeping, maybe it's the supervisor of maintenance, or maybe it's a supervisor of nursing. Whatever, you know, something comes up, they want something, you want something, and it may or may not be poles apart. We can yield. We can withdraw. We can win. We can resolve. We can compromise. And in the second part, or the middle part of the sheet here, when we're looking for a high concern with relationships, we're concerned about that person. We're also concerned with interacting with them. We will move toward working in resolvement and in compromise. If you look at the left-hand side, if we are low in achieved needs, sometimes we have to struggle. And in struggling, we will just yield to that situation, or we will withdraw. If we're high in achieved needs, then that means that we'll struggle to resolve or to win. We do an at our clinic in Denver, in Longmont, we do an awful lot of marriage counseling, a lot of other kind of counseling too. But one of the things that we find that works so desperately against marriages is where there has to be two persons that must win at the other's expense. There are win-win situations where both husband and wife can win, but if winning means losing for the other person, it can be very defacing, you see. That also happens on the job. That can also happen with parent-child relationships. Up until about 5-10 years ago, it wasn't also kosher for psychologists to disclose too much. But since that period of time, it's very okay for us to let you in to see how we tick, just so you don't get too far in there and see how we tick all the time. One of my early life motivations to get me into the field of psychology was the relationship I had with my father, and as a result with my mother. It was high in conflict. Now, the Cullens are English, Irish, Scotch, Welsh, and 164th Italian, whatever that means. That comes out every generation. My sister walked in here, you wouldn't recognize us as being from the same family. In fact, all of my family's rather dark in skin tone. After all, I was hoping to work with him, you know, and make a good impression so that he would send us lots of clients. And he said, okay, I became a surgeon and an MD because I decided when I had polio and I was lying in bed at age 10 that I was going to conquer death. Now, why did you go into psychology? And I said, because I had so many questions unanswered, I figured it would take a lifetime for me to figure me out, so I became a psychologist. And in a sense, we all are. That's right. How often, you know, those little kids around the household, now, once they get to be teenagers, they know more than anyone else in the world, but until that time, there's a point, you know, through those years, they come in and say, Daddy, why this, why that? Mommy, why this, why that? And they're looking for concepts, and they're wanting answers, but they're also needing to test their independence. My mother tells the story to her best friends, and that ruins your reputation, you know. When I was 14 months old, I decided that I was not going to be fed by an external force. I was going to eat. And she, being also, you know, married into the Collins tribe, meant that she had to have some of the same problems because she had a lot of will herself. She was determined to feed this little Collins, and I was determined that she wasn't going to feed this little Collins. And I went 3 days without food. And finally, she weakened more than me and decided that she would give me things that I could stuff in my mouth, you know. And we got through that little crisis. I began to eat again. And pretty soon I learned that with a spoon, you do the most unnatural thing in all the world. You take a spoon and you take it like this and you dip in and get something and then you turn it around and come this way. You don't go naturally like this. And then I found when our oldest came along, she had to learn exactly the same thing. I mean, they didn't even have a vaccination for it. And then our second one came along and she had to learn the same thing. And if we'd had 10 kids, they'd all had to learn the same thing. That the spoon must go around this way rather than this way. And that's, by the time our second one came along, I made a truce with my wife. And I said, hey, you know, let's get away with this nonsense for about 6 weeks, 8 weeks. That's all it's going to take. And let's feed her hot dogs. Let's give her, you know, French fries or tater tots, whatever. Something that she can pick up while she's battering away with Daddy. Now, we can override some of those areas of independence, and we can force our will on the child. We can do that. And that child will learn to open their mouth and swallow. And there are some times when challenges need to be met just that way. But there are other times when we create a tremendous amount of resistance when the person is overcompliant. One of the things that I say to parents when they come in and they tell me about Johnny or Susie being a perfect model child, well, they don't have any Collins blood in them. That's number one. We know they don't have any Collins blood because we weren't model children. Oh, we were good in front of company. We did get that down pretty pat, that our hides would be skinned if we were not good in front of company. But between my sister telling me when we were washing and drying dishes that I was really adopted, but my parents didn't want me to know it, and that's why they said I was theirs. And it wasn't, you know, I was really up there, tall young man before I really came to grips with the fact that I was really natively a Collins. But if you look at the family structure of the face and all these big heads running around, there's no question in the world, but, you know, I'm part of the tribe. I really am a part of the tribe. Well, we learn to deal with conflict, and how we deal with it, how we resolve it, is important. And sometimes, you know, parents get behaviors out of children, or employees get behaviors out of their employers, get behavior out of their employees, or supervisors out of their subordinates, when we actually would be better off to have a little resistance on the surface and work through it. Say, now, Jim, be careful there. Be careful there. Let me share it this way. When children are growing up, most parents like to really clamp on them, you know. And until that child gets to about 15, 16, 17, 18, and then we have Hiroshima all over again. You may reflect on the neighbor's kids, if not your own. Or maybe you've got Hiroshima coming in a year or two. But one of the things we find, if we can, not just tolerating misbehavior, but if we can understand what's going on in the process of all that behavior. Now, I talk about my kids because we're experiencing them from day to day. For instance, a few months ago, our 8-year-old, well, she was about, I guess, 6 and a half at that point. It was getting later in the afternoon, evening, and I had reminded her once that 8:15 was her bedtime. I don't care how long it takes them to put on their pajamas. I wouldn't want it to be all day, but if it takes them 30 minutes or an hour to put their pajamas on, that's okay. But when bedtime comes, they go to bed. That's just, you know, that's just like the law of the Medes and Persians. That's the way it is at the Collins household. Well, she was trying to work on that. After all, parents are a challenge for children, in case you've been a parent and a kid. You probably are aware of that. And they have a right to challenge us. So she began telling me some stories, and they were very interesting, by the way. Just because kids are little doesn't mean that they're dumb. You know, they have nothing but time. All our inmates at Marion Federal Prison, I wondered why they got into such orneriness and meanness. And Alan said to me one day, 27 acres is our lifespan. You've made it so we can't get out of here. And we have 365 days to spend. We have a newspaper to read and a TV to watch. And we've got lots of time to think, a lot more time to think than you have. And it was nothing to just use the system against the system to really flub the works. That's why chewing gum was contraband in the prison. Have you ever thought how much fun someone has chewing up a wad or two or three sticks of chewing gum, get it all real gooey and mushy, and sticking it in a keyhole? And then have you ever tried to dig chewing gum out of a keyhole? Have you ever tried to watch one of the maintenance men dig chewing gum out of a keyhole after they've frozen it with Freon, cursing all the time? Yeah. Well, you see, our minds work. All of our minds work. How we put it into practice is important. How we look at resistances. Candy said to me, Dad, when you were a little boy, did they have TVs back then? And I said, now look, I am your father, but I'm not that old. And then she pulled another one and she said, well, did they have horses and buggies back then? And I said, yes, but not near as many as they did when Grandpa Collins was a young man. And then she said, were the Indians shooting arrows back then? And I began to feel myself going way further and further back into antiquity, you see. And then, you know what she said? Dad, there's this program that comes on at 8 o'clock that's a real neat special, and I'd like to watch it. And she had her hook right square in me, you know? And I said, you know something? Tonight is a school night, and you're going to bed. Well, I drooped her flower just a little bit, but we got the point across. She wanted to use all her feminine wiles to kind of hook me. And we have a progression of those kind of ingenuity, those kinds of things of ingenuity coming about from year to year and month to month as the girls are growing. I've been Uncle Jim to several hundred young people as I worked in juvenile home. And then also when I was working in church youth work many years ago, that was a lot of fun. We're all into an area of needing to deal with communication and working with conflict resolution. You know, seeing where I am at this point in life, and with we not only have the seven therapists that are on staff, including myself, full time, but then we have six interns. And they're sort of a, you know, next level down so far as responsibility and so forth. And they get pegged with a lot of things. And it's interesting to watch all this dynamic going around between all 14 of us, because we've got a secretary and then the 13 of us that work in the office. It's a real neat system to watch going. And it's also nice to realize that when there are tensions there, for we're human beings, that when we come along and we positively reinforce each other, it makes for the communication to come around to a point where in the resolution we have a win-win kind of situation rather than a win-loss-lose kind of situation. The principles that are laid down here, I'm throwing a lot of material at you today that you can go back home and you can digest as you get back at your own home stations. For resolving conflict, number one, listen carefully to the other person. Oftentimes, when I'm endeavoring to resolve conflict, I will say to that person, "This is what I think I hear you saying. Is this what you meant? This is what I think I hear you saying. Is that what you meant?" Or when someone is needing to get a message across, like a 12-year-old who's getting preoccupied with teenageism and all that thing, you know. And I say to my daughter, "Elizabeth," and that's sort of command performance, like my name used to be Jimmy Harrell. That was an official title, and that meant official business. I was Jim all the rest of my life, except when we were dealing with very serious matters, like transgressions that I shouldn't have done. And then we used official titles. And when I said, "Elizabeth, what I said was this, and I restate it. Is that what you heard?" We've never liked her to leave her coat lying on the dining room floor, and that seems to be a favorite place, and we've worked on it for several years. And we've gotten reinforcing mechanisms that when she forgets, then she gets to do some things to kind of help her remember. Listening carefully. But how often do we hear persons talking and we don't quite hear? Someone says something to us. And then defining the problem. What is the situation? Whether it's at work, and we need to define something to a person who's working directly under us, or we need to define it to someone else that's an online staff person, or whether it's in the home. Making a definition. Defining areas of agreement and disagreement. Identifying your contribution to the problem and sharing the behaviors you're willing to change. When someone comes in, always leave the door open that perhaps you can learn from the situation. You can learn from the situation. Help me to understand this. I've not always been a psychologist. At one point in my college career, I was painting houses. I got a lot of paint on me in the process, but I painted. I mowed lawns. I've worked in grocery stores and done just a little bit of everything. Work, good hard work, never hurt a soul. And it's important for us with our young people that growing up in our families. And I believe Dan told me that one of the youngest persons here who is an employee is 18, 19 years of age. I think that's great from a standpoint of of using the opportunity of all ages, of working together, so that you're able to understand what's happening and being willing to listen, being able to understand the kind of stresses that come within our lives. All of us are called upon to do some kinds of work in periods of our life when they're high stress. Those of you who are parents have probably sat up all night long by the bedside of a child that had 103 or 104 fever, wishing that you had purchased a little more Tylenol, or wishing that you could get a hold of the doctor, or not, you know, wishing he wasn't out of town or whatever, so that you could help that child, and maybe even that didn't work. You simply, as a result of being the parent, or being the responsible person, you were there. And it's important to understand the kind of stresses that affect us. So you don't happen to be the RNs on staff. You don't happen to be perhaps the LPNs on staff and that are actually administering pills or IVs or whatever to those persons in the nursing home. You carry a very, very vital function. You carry a very, very vital function. But it doesn't mean that you're without stress. Now, I believe you had handed to you a next test, which is called the Holmes-Rey stress test. And I would remind you that none of these are to be shared with anyone else. This is purely for your own benefit. I'd like to give you about 4 or 5, maybe 6 minutes to go through and just check through, or if you want to write out, for instance, if in this last 12 months, you've had the death of a spouse, then write 100 on that line. If there's been a divorce, marital separation, any of the areas here, and then I want you to add up each column and then add up the total. We'll give you just a few moments to do that, and I think you'll be able to see something of real enlightenment within yourself and also your line employees. Within the last 12 months. If that happened, or if something happened 12 or 13 months, 14 months, I think it could be counted within the last year. And would you mind, as soon as you finish adding your score up, just kind of slip up in your hand and then back down so I can kind of tell where we're at. You've done it. Okay. Coming through with the scores and tabulating the scores. If your score is less than 150, there's only about a 37% chance that you will have a major illness within 2 years. If your score is 150 to 300, you'll have a 51% chance of having some major physical illness or depression. If your score is over 300, there's about an 80% chance that you will have some major illness or sense of depression affecting you as a result of all these stress factors that come. And if we run through some of the major categories of the husband-wife, like the spouse relationship, a death or divorce or separation, death of a close family member, the person being incarcerated, personal injury or illness, believe it or not, even getting married can be a significant stress. Those of you who don't know that should get married and try it. Getting fired from work. Having a marital reconciliation is not quite as stressful as getting married. And we don't have time to really get into some of the intricacies of all this, but it's really very interesting. Retirement. And part of this can be lapped over to the retirement of a spouse that can be rather traumatic within the household and the nuclear family. Change in a family member's health. For instance, if a person has become ill with some kind of perhaps major illness. A pregnancy. Sexual difficulties within the marriage. In addition to the family, this includes children, it also includes
stepchildren. It includes son-in-laws, daughter-in-laws, father-in-laws, mother-in-laws, and step-parents as well. A business readjustment, change in financial status, and coming on down, a change in the number of marital arguments that can create a tremendous amount of stress. A mortgage or loan over $10,000 has a tremendous amount of pressure for a person. A foreclosure on a loan or a mortgage. Change in work responsibilities, which some of you may have had. Son or daughter leaving home, and some of you are at the age where that may be happening. Trouble with in-laws. Outstanding personal achievement. One set would say, well, Jim, if a person has gotten some acclamation or some fame or some reward for personal achievement, it seems like that would be positive. But it also adds stress in the person's interaction with other people. Believe it or not, when the spouse begins or starts to work, some of you may be spouses who have gone back to work after maybe a 5 or 10 or 15 year lapse of time. And that can create a considerable amount of rearrangement within the home nuclear structure. Who's going to fix dinner? Who's going to clean up the dishes? Who's going to mop the floor? Who's going to vacuum? Who's going to make the beds? Who's going to do the laundry? Who's going to take out the garbage and the trash? All of those things are involved there. Having trouble with the boss. Of course, at Bethesda, that never happens. With those in the other departments. Change in work hours or conditions. If suddenly you are thrown on night shift and you've been used to day shift, or you've been used to day shift and you have to go on evening shift, or maybe the days of the week that have to be worked differently. A change in residence, a change in schools for children, change in recreational habits or church activities or social activities. A mortgage loan under $10,000. And you notice that's 18 points of stress, and over 10,000 is 31 points of stress. These are major issues. One of the things that we do a great deal of is working with persons who have blood pressure and heart problems. And one of the things that we dig into, a person, and oftentimes they'll come in and sit down in the counseling office and you say, hey, Joe or Mary or Bill or Jim, what's eating at you? Nothing. I'm doing great. And I generally say, well, now that we have the public relations taken care of, let's shut the door and get down to the basic truth. What's eating on you? Because some of these things are eating on us in a constant way. Vacations can be stress. I have seen some families that I've worked with have vacations that I thought were up about the 50th or 60th percentile rather than down at a 13 because of what was happened there. And in some families, the Christmas season, especially Christmas time, could be a very high tension level. Being in the counseling business in the last 6 years, this coming July, will be 6 years for Christian counseling, we have worked with over 2,600 different family units in that period of time. And 1 week of the year that we are not closed is the week of Christmas. Between Christmas and New Year's, we could work about 20 hours a day if we would. That may shock you. It may not shock you. Ideas, expectations, and all those things that come around but don't necessarily get fulfilled within the life of the family members and all the kinds of conflict that can go on there. It becomes very heavy. Keep that, and I want to go on to another area right here. As I'm talking, I'd like you to go down through the self-assessment inventory. It's got a lot of lines on it, up and down and cross lines on it. Just as we're talking, you listen to me with your right ear, if that's the ear that you hear the best out of. If not, do it with the left. And use the other ear to talk to yourself while you're making your check marks with regard to those personal attributes that you see in yourself. For as you are seeing yourself in the position that you're in,
What kind of person am I? Am I a compassionate person? Do I like myself? Am I interested in my career? Have I set goals? Am I committed to personal growth? Do I have a faith in God? Am I a forgiving person? Do I have peace of mind? All those areas there. Part of what makes us up is every part of our being. And that includes the person that people see when we come on the job. That includes what our kids see. That includes what our parents or our husband or our wife sees. That includes what the neighbors see. But it also includes what we know about ourselves. And that's vital in your functioning. And Bethesda is very concerned in how you function, what makes you function, and you're having the least amount of stress as best they can help you in your life. There may be many things that they cannot do for you in your particular city or town or locale, but there are many things that they can. And one of the things that is centered in and around these conferences is to better understand your needs and how you can see your position in that healthcare facility back in Nebraska, Iowa, Texas, Kansas, wherever it might be, that you are able to deal with the challenge of living for you. We don't know, for any of us, whether we will die poor or rich. Most of us will not die rich or very rich. Most of us will be of very modest income, but we may be virtually without funds coming to the end of life. But we do have our memories. I think of my grandmother, I believe one of the world's dearest persons, through all the tempestuous teen years that I went through, and in my early 20s, my grandmother was a very good psychologist. She didn't have a lot of tools, theoretical tools about psychology that I'm supposed to have learned and have learned, many of them. But when I would come in very angry, very frustrated, she would get sort of preoccupied in the kitchen. And she could make the best banana nut bread west of the Mississippi, unless that was in your household. But anyway, she made awfully good banana nut bread. She could make excellent apple pies, cherry pies. And while she was stirring up banana nut bread, or whatever it was, she would be asking me to tell her about the problem. Well, I've never timed it, and I haven't gone back to see how long it takes to stir up bread and get it stuck in the oven. But about the time she'd get it stuck in the oven, then she would make herself a cup of hot tea, and she would sit down to listen a little bit more. One of the things that my grandmother was an excellent listener. An excellent listener. And also a person with a great deal of understanding and a great deal of love. And you take that combination of love and of understanding and care. And she had a grandson that would swear by her because of the consideration that came my way at times in my life when I was not especially lovely. I may not take the world's Emmy Award for being lovely today, but in those days, there was a lot of tempestuousness going on. I had a lot of struggle going on growing up, and she was there to understand and to care. It's important that we have that. And then we turn over to the other side of that piece of paper. And I'm not wanting these for myself. I'm simply wanting these for your own growth and development. And I would like you, first of all, to not do this now. Do it later at a time where you pencil in very lightly. If you have a spouse, do your spouse. Now remember, this is going to be just secretly between you and the walls and
God, the devil, and nobody else. You pencil in lightly the name of your spouse or a child or a next of kin, and then you pencil in the name of your supervisor. And of course, that you don't want to leave lying around where anybody can see that. And then next, you pencil in lightly the name of a person that you may be supervising. And then lastly, I'd like you to put in your name as you perceive others seeing you. Now, you do that, you know, in your room tonight, sometime before you go home. Won't take you very long. Just do it quickly. If you have different colored pencils, you might do it. And just go through it hurriedly so that you have a score there and you begin to look at what happens as we begin to look at how well we see others communicating and how well we feel we communicate ourselves. Dan, I have one more handout. And because you are committed to the caring business, yes, two pages there. I've entitled this last handout, "To Live Without Loving is Really Not to Live at All." I just want to run down through some of these and leave it with you, and within a few minutes we'll be ready for dinner time right here in the Colorado Rockies. How do we feel that others feel about us, and then how do we feel about ourselves? How do we feel about others? I'm convinced in my 45 years of living that parenting is not so much a biological action as it is a commitment. For I have seen, well, for instance, I will talk about some of my relatives. They're not here today, so I can talk about them. I have a real neat brother-in-law who is a Protestant chaplain at Leavenworth Federal Prison. I guess I can stop long enough to say this. When I was working in the prison at Marion, Illinois, and my brother-in-law, Manfred Craig, was Protestant chaplain at Leavenworth Federal Prison, my wife's mother came to visit us, and we took her to church, and she met the minister down in First Baptist Church down in Carbondale, Illinois. And Dr. Elbert was a neat person, and he said, "Well, what do you think about your son-in-law being a psychologist?" And she said, "Well, you know, I was the oldest of 18 children. I raised 6 children. I tried to live a godly life and tried to share with them what was right and wrong. But I didn't realize that 2 of our families would wind up in prison after all that work." We had quite a time. Fortunately, we were able to go home at night, and that was pretty neat. However, you know, the caring that we do, the implanting of values, that doesn't mean that we have to lecture with stern lectures. That means the person that you are, what you stand for within the community. If you're an honest person, if you're a happy person, if you're a sad person, all of that comes through one way or the other. And with this last handout, I'd like to share some of these things, and I'll just glance through. You can take the opportunity later to go over these materials more completely for yourself. But it's asking you questions coming from yourself. Have I sufficient sense of self-worth that I can look away from myself and see my partner? And in this situation, we also can look at a supervisor or an employee as a deeply valued person worthy of my utmost caring. One of the things that make for happy families, at the University of Oklahoma, in the Medical Center, Oklahoma City,
Some 15 years ago, there was a very extensive test that they ran, comparing happy families with unhappy families. And you know, the major difference that they found between the happy families and the unhappy families? The major difference. Anybody have an idea? Don't you all speak at once? The major difference was the fact that they appreciated each other in the family relationship, parent to child, husband to wife, wife to husband, child to parent. And not only did they appreciate each other, but they were verbal about it. And sometimes, you know, with the price of gold escalating, we value our thank yous and our pleases more than the price of gold. And that's kind of a heavy number. And sometimes, you know, just walking up and taking hold of the arm of a person that you're working around, or a family member, or patting them on the shoulder, and without getting, you know, too friendly, in hug therapy, you can put your arm around them, give them a good tight squeeze, and say, "Hey, I appreciate the job that you're doing. I care about you. I love you." After, you know, you've gotten the oxygen and the ambulance cart, and you've gotten them repaired from their heart attack that they had after you told them that you love them, they'll recover. People recover quickly from those things, but they do like to know that they count. And one of the things that's impressed me about this organization in meeting these fellas at the top is the fact that they count, and they want you to know that you count. And they feel very deeply that every person in the organization counts. You know, the human body is a very important mechanism. Have any of you lost a toe or a finger? Have any of you ever lost a toe or a finger? That's amazing. We've got about 65, 70 people, and not one person has lost a toe or a finger.
Almost.
Thank you. That kind of helps our national norms. I would almost photograph you if there were 100 people here and we had not one person that wasn't missing a toe or a finger. They don't seem like, you know, and they're difficult. Your toes are difficult to wash, and kids don't like to wash their toes, you know. And they'll tell you that they've washed their hands when you can look on them and see streaks and stripes, and it doesn't look like that was the way they were born, you know. They're messy things to work with, but they're important. But have you ever been without the use of your hand or your foot for even a day? Have you? What's it like? You hop around on one leg, or you take a crutch, or sometimes you have to go in a wheelchair, you know, or you bruise your thumb, you know. You ever bruise your thumb and somebody comes up and starts, "Hello, Jim," and you, "Hello," you know, you stick out that other hand and you pull this one back. Or you very pensively stick that hand out and you think they're going to grab it, and then you kind of come back this way or protect it some way if you bruise it. Why? Not very big. Just a few muscles, a few bones in there. Why do we smart so when that happens? It's because they're important. And you're important too. You know, I've got a real firm feeling, not only are you important to all these men in Colorado Springs and to your own administrators in the homes, but you're also important to your families. They need you more than you might realize. I look back at my turbulent teen years and some of my 20s, which weren't too good either. And I'm thankful for those that were willing to love in spite of who I was right at that point. They certainly didn't love me because of who I was. They loved me because they had more of a bright hope for the future than I did. But then we're also looked upon and cared by someone else. And that's our Maker. Don't ever forget that. He cares. Wise man said many, many years ago that there isn't a sparrow that falls to the ground. But what he doesn't take note. And even the hairs of our head are numbered. And with some of us, he must have the calculator going pretty steady, because that comes, well, mostly on the subtraction side as the years have come. And take your personal worth. You get up tomorrow morning and, you know, you're here in beautiful Colorado, and you've got to walk around these grounds because it's just absolutely gorgeous. That's beautiful. But not a one of those rocks can think. Not a one of those rocks can talk. Now, the trees may talk a little. The wind blows. You'll hear them whistling down through the canyon here. Those are things that God created, yes. But he also created you. Don't forget it. That's his choice creation, was he, when he created human beings. Value that possession, take care of it, and you'll have a tremendous investment, not only in today, but in tomorrow, in the future, and in the ages to come. Take from this conference a lot of strength and go home and be a much better person, because you know the folk here care, and you've met some of the other Bethesda family, and you realize that they care too, and you'll be a much better person for it. God bless you.
Thank you so much, Jim. Appreciated that. Just a couple of things to wrap up, and it's supper time. Jim talking about walking around the grounds, and they do encourage you to get out and see the beautiful country that we have here. But the people at Glen Eyrie ask, if you go very far, if you're going to walk very far, at least take somebody else along with you. In case you happen to fall or get hurt, somebody else can come back and get help for you. They do request that you not climb the high, steep rocks. They'd like you to stay off of those. But there's some real beautiful hiking trails that maybe early in the morning when you get up, you'd have a chance to enjoy. Well, now that you've had a chance to sit for a while and let some of the butterflies settle or leave after that plane ride this morning, we're going to be having supper. Speaking of butterfly, reminds me of the time the two caterpillars were crawling across the grass, and a butterfly flew over. The caterpillars looked up, and the one caterpillar nudged the other one and said, "You'll never get me up in one of those things." So I think some of you maybe were like that. Maybe your first flight, or never thought you'd get up in one, but you did it, and you made it, and it was fun, a neat experience. After supper, we would like for you to meet back up here in the great room. We're going to be given a tour of the castle, which includes some of the history. It's very interesting. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. So after supper time, after you've had a chance to stretch, then we'll meet back up here. Steve, Ruby, would you ask God's blessing on our supper tonight?
Heavenly Father, again, we thank you for your goodness. We thank you, Lord, for this afternoon's lecture and activities. We pray that